If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
I think that John Gacy was the end of innocence, if there ever was any, in Chicago area. I think that people trusted a person like Gacy, who was connected in the community. Chicago's a very connected community. We all know each other. And Gacy was one of those people who was respected. And I think that we now saw that he, despite the fact that he was connected, despite the fact that he was doing the right thing in front of society, the things, the horror that he was perpetrating was something that Chicago just had to learn.
That was Karen Conti talking on John Borowski's new series, which is called The John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago, which is available on Amazon Prime, and I would highly, highly recommend watching it. John Borowski is here in studio. He's one of Chicago's very own. He's an award-winning independent filmmaker with a focus on later 19th century and early 20th century serial killers. He produced H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer, and Serial Killer Culture, which examines why people are fascinated by serial killers. Welcome to the studio. Hi, John.
Thank you for having me, Karen. I'm proud to be on your show, and I'm glad you published your book about your experience.
Yeah, so we kind of have always bonded over our common, I guess we should say subject matter, right?
Right, exactly.
as odd as that is, many of you do know that I represented John Gacy in the final set of his death row appeals, not to get him out of prison, but to stop the death penalty. And spoiler alert, I was unsuccessful with that representation. But I just wanted first to congratulate you on this series. It's really well done. It's really different than the other series. And it's an 8-episode series. And we know there have been movies. In fact, there's another one filming right now. You and I just spoke about that. What do you think you wanted to do with this series that was different than some of the other ones that are out there?
Well, I really, like all my other documentaries, I wanted to put Gacy's life under a microscope and leave no stone unturned. I studied the actual case reports, the police files. I interviewed over 25 people who knew Gacy or who were involved with the case. And it took me 5 years. But, you know, being from Chicago, I thought it was an important story to tell because I was around 6 years old when Gacy was arrested for the murders in 1978. So it fascinated me. And the more I looked into it, I thought, even though I've read a lot of these books and people think they know John Wayne Gacy, this was a huge case with hundreds and hundreds of people involved. So there still are things that people could learn, as you've shown in your book and I've shown in my miniseries.
And, you know, it is interesting because he was so prolific in killing, number one. Number two, so there's victims and victims' families who are out there. And I always say, you know, if I'm ever giving a talk about the death penalty and I'm in Chicago, if there's more than 50 or 100 people there, there are at least two or three victims, family members, or friends of victim. It's so pervasive, and even now, the ramifications of those crimes are resonating, you know, in our city, and all the cops who were involved, and everyone who tried the case, all the lawyers over the 14 years he was on death row. There are so many people that were touched by this whole thing, and so, you know, what. If there's anything that you learned during the making of this series, what is it that you take away that's new and different from what maybe is already out there?
Well, you know, there were two people that stood in front of Gacy's cell in Des Plaines after he was arrested. One was the detective, Mike Albrecht, and the other was Larry Finder, the assistant state's attorney. And they were standing in front of his cell, and two things, important things happened there. Gacy showed them how he did the rope trick strangling his victims with his own crucifix, his own rosary. And he did that. He put that on Larry Finder's hand to show him how he strangled his victims. And he said, this is the neck. And then Gacy drew them a drawing of his crawl space, which he identified where all these bodies were. So he knew where all the bodies were. He was a contractor. As you know, he had all these numbers, and he knew where these bodies were. And for what, 50 years ago, since 50 years ago, nobody's ever gotten these two guys together on camera. And both of their stories were important to be told because they were both in front of Gacy's cell. And that's just one of the things I did. I brought these two together on camera to explain, yes, this is how he did it, because there's a lot of myths and misconceptions in the Gacy case. Did he actually draw that drawing? As we know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories as well. But I uncovered a lot of new things, like there wasn't really a smell in there. And, you know, the officers created that to, they had to have another search warrant. They needed evidence for that. So they created that smell, and I don't fault them. I think, hey, they did a good thing. They caught him. So there are many new things. It, just like your book, if you think you've known Gacy, you don't, because there are so many stories. And what I do is I provide the context. There's a lot of content out there, you know, but the context is most important. Why did he do these things? What about his upbringing caused him to do these things?
And I think that that is one of the things that I liked about your series, is that you really delved into that. I mean, you got a lot of information about his upbringing, and you put it in perspective of the times, you know. And again, you know, back in the time he was growing up in the 40s and 50s, yes, you had families that were very traditional, where you may have had a father going out to work, and maybe he used corporal punishment at home. Maybe the mother was a more passive stay-at-home, you know, coddler of children, you know, not to use bad, you know, words on any of these things, but that was kind of the nature of what happened. And also, it wasn't a time for gay people to be accepted. And, you know, some of the background you give, you really give some deep background of, because we forget, what was it like if you were growing up in 1940s and 50s and you're gay? I mean, you know, can you at least tell our listeners a little bit about what the backdrop of all of this stuff?
Yeah, and that's the context as well. It's not just Gacy and his murders. It's the societal factors that came into play there too. You know, here he is in the 50s. You know, he's, you know, an adolescent. He's coming into his teen years. He feels attracted to males, and he has to hide that. You know, negativity about homosexuals were all around in that time period. You know, you hear it from your school, your parents, church, everywhere. So, you know, that created these feelings with him, and that's what started that duality, to where, you know, he grew to hate himself because his father would demean him, make fun of him, physically, verbally abuse him. And, you know, the mom did coddle him in that sense, like, you know, she wanted to protect him, and she said he had these ailments, which he never really had. So in his mind, he thought there were problems with his body. He thought he had a heart condition. But in all the tests they ever did on John Wayne Gacy, they never found anything wrong with him, physiologically or psychologically. Nothing abnormal came up.
So, and it's speculative that perhaps what he was doing was just sort of blocking the massive stress, and the way to do it was to fall down and either fake a pass out, or maybe he actually did pass out from the stress. Hey, Jack, can we play one of those segments? I think it's the psychiatrist segment. And this is coming from Dr.
Helen Morrison, who was Gacy's psychiatrist.
And she was the one who had examined his brain posthumously to see if there was anything organically wrong with his brain, and she concluded that there was not. Go ahead, Jack.
The father felt he was a namby-pamby kind of kid, and he wondered if he really needed to have this child be like him, or if he could just write him off.
It's almost like he gave up trying to fit into what his father wanted him to be, like he knew that he couldn't be it. And unfortunately, probably some of the things his dad said to him led him to believe that. But then his mom's overprotectiveness prevented him from even trying some of those things. And that's where you see sometimes with other serial killers and psychopaths, that you'll see there was an unhealthy relationship with the mother, where there was coddling, overprotection, those type of things. What that does is it can help develop narcissistic behaviors, because the world revolves around them.
Very, very interesting. And one of the things that I talk about in my book, and I think some of your interviews brought this out, was that when Gacy was around me, as opposed to the other male attorneys, and he had all male attorneys for 14 years, and he had a lot of them, I was the only female. And When I spoke to him, he had a whole different demeanor. You know, he had this tough guy sort of way of talking like that, you know. But when he was with me, his voice would get, you know, softer. He would be more effeminate. He wanted to talk to me about things that he was interested in rather than sports. He would talk about how he liked to garden and how he liked to cook. And, you know, you could see that he had those tendencies. And his father, who named him John Wayne Gacy, I mean, for God's sake, got John Wayne, Mr. Macho, right? You know, yeah. There's nobody more macho in the 40s than John Wayne. And he just didn't live up to that, right?
No. And that, right, you're given this name of John Wayne, you know, Gacy, to live up to this American, you know, hero of the stage and screen. And he had a lot to live up to. So he had all this pressure that his whole life he tried to become someone and show his father he could become someone. And unfortunately, he did. You know, when he was married to his second wife, he would tell her, look, you're going to see my names on the newspapers all around the world. And he was right.
He was right. But she probably had no idea. And I don't think either of his wives had any idea. You know, I don't think he was the worst husband at all either. I mean, as far as, you know, that era, I mean, you know, he was a provider. He was good as a stepfather. He was good as a father. He, you know, he wasn't a bad guy, you know, on the outside. But yet, you know, when the wives were living there, you know, there was stuff going on even at that time. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this, but let's just, I've got about a minute left here. There, of all the serial killers, you know, we somehow, I think, rank Gacy as one of the most fascinating because of his prolific nature and because of the bodies, you know, that are kept close. What other reasons do you think that people are so attracted to the story?
I think, you know, that they, you know, could identify with the story either if they've ever been a teenager or a young person or if they've had children, you know, understanding that, you know, you could potentially be a victim as well. But I think, you know, that whole clown aspect, that fascinates people, even though he never murdered anyone dressed as a clown. So, and that the fact that he buried 26 bodies under his crawl space, the rest on his property, and then throwing them in a river, that's what it was. People wonder, you know, how can somebody do this when they're in society and they have neighbors and they're working and they're working in politics? And that's why he used it as a ruse. That was his perfect cover.
Well, it was. And one of the things that I talk about in my book, in the day of the execution, he had some neighbors who came to say goodbye to him. Hey, you know what? They love that guy. He would mow their lawn. He would, you know, make them meals. He was a good dude, you know, to them. And there was unconditional affection for him despite the horrific nature of these crimes. So, again, like so many contradictions, and it really kind of confuses you. We're talking to John Borowski. He is an award-winning independent filmmaker. He had just released a new documentary, The John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago, available on Amazon Prime. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show here on WGN. We're talking to John Borowski. He's an award-winning independent filmmaker, and he just released a fabulous new series. It's an 8-part series called The John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago, available on Amazon Prime. Highly recommend it. John, you know, we were talking a little bit about Gacy's father and his role. And again, I think you and I both agree, and I want to say this, that just because you were, you know, abused by your parent, you know, and or you were gay, does not turn you into a serial killer. That's,
no.
You know, there's many people who grow up in an abusive yes. environment and have all of those things, but don't end up killing 33.
True.
People. So, but you know, there seems to be a controversy in the Gacy family, having we both of us know some of the Gacy members. Was there any question in your mind that Gacy's father was in fact abusive, given what you know?
No, there was no question of that, because in my detailed research, I even found quotes from his sister and his mother, who both said he hated Gacy. He was a mean man. He was an alcoholic. He was a drunk. He threw Gacy against the wall. It was their own words. So, I mean, I don't think they were lying. So I took their words, and pretty much that you know, made up that entire story, because Gacy himself, you know, admitted, okay, yeah, my dad was kind of bad, but, you know, it's all the evidence from the mouths of his sister and his mother, you know. And then I back it up with experts, you know, that talk about the psychology of it and the sociological aspect of how this affected him. The words being called dumb and stupid over and over again, and, you know, the physical abuse, you know, all of that stuff played heavily on Gacy's mind, I'm sure. And then, you know, there's also the mother aspect. Not many people know, you know, that how negative that was, you know, when he was younger, you know, she was treating him with pharmaceuticals because she thought he had issues, but he really didn't. And that, I'm sure, played a issue in his mind at some point, too.
And, you know, you have, you know, and Gacy, when I spoke with him over the 40, 50 hours I spent with him, you know, he would use that, those terms, dumb and stupid. Yep. And I'd say, John, isn't that a little redundant? You know, and he'd be like, no, that's what my dad used to say. My dad would say dumb and stupid. Let's play that clip, Jack. That'll probably be a good time to play it now.
You can go back and look at labeling theory from back at that time frame.
You're dumb and you're stupid.
You tell somebody they're stupid enough times and they're stupid.
Stupid, stupid.
You tell them that they're dumb and they're worthless enough times and yeah, they're dumb and they're worthless.
Dumb, stupid. You're worthless.
Took Johnny to the basement, picked up a 2x4 board and whacked him so much that by the time he was through, Johnny was almost dead. Sometimes he would attack Marion or the two girls, but Johnny was the most hated by his father.
And that was his childhood friend.
Yeah, Barry Boschelli. He grew up with him.
He grew up with him, and he would sit and have family dinners with him, right?
Yeah, and see, at that time period, too, you know, the family wanted to secure their family. They don't want any secrets to get out, because then that would destroy their image of that perfect 40s and 50s family. They couldn't take him. One doctor said he should be admitted to a psychiatric hospital. The mother said no. Why? Because at that time, nobody wanted to be labeled crazy. If you went to see a psychiatrist, you're labeled as crazy, and everyone would know it. Even Larry Finder, the assistant state's attorney who was involved with the case during the trial, he said he wanted to go to therapy, but he couldn't. He said it would ruin his career as an attorney. He couldn't, because you're going to be labeled as crazy. So, you know, there were all these things that were going on, you know, during that, you know, his upbringing, and his mom played a part in that too. But she also had that fear of being seen that way by society.
And again, that's part and parcel of what it was like to grow up. I mean, as we just said, it wasn't cool to be gay. You know, domestic abuse was not what it is now. You know, where you hit a kid and the DCFS comes in, right?
Exactly. Right. There were no watchdogs at that time.
No watchdogs, and then you know you add to it this idea that getting mental health help is a good thing, not a bad thing. And, you know, you just wonder if there's going to be a point in time where we can actually say this person is going to be a serial killer. Let's do something about it. Can you medicate? Can you counsel away those urges? Is there a point of no return? And that, to me, is always the fascinating question.
Yeah. And there is a school in Florida that is working with little children that may show signs of future psychopathy like that. You know, whether they're, you know, kind of showing that, you know, animosity towards their brother or sister and wishing they were dead and acting out in those ways, you know, worse than what a normal child might do. So you're right. Maybe we don't know. We don't even know what causes it yet. There are different theories. You know, what I've discovered through my researches of these serial killers, I feel it's environmental factors, especially when they're a child. What are they growing up in, and how's that going to affect them? And it will for the rest of their life.
Oh, absolutely. And I think sometimes now the serial killers are not killing as many, and we don't have as many serial killers, probably because they're apprehended sooner. Yes. But now we have school shooters.
Yeah, the mass murders have taken over that because, you know, they're in this pain and they want to show the world, look, you never paid attention to me. And then they take as many people out as they can and then themselves. And that's their statement.
Did it ever occur to you that, like, if Gacy were born, you know, 40 years later, that he maybe would have been a school shooter instead of what he did,
probably,
you know, acting out in some other way. So, you know, one of the things that there are a lot of conspiracy theories. I mean, you and I have talked about this for years and years, and they're interesting. They are very interesting about were there more victims, were there more perpetrators, you know, were there other purposes to killing that were monetary in nature? Let's start with, were there more victims? What is your best guess, or I'd say very educated guess, knowing what you know about this case?
Right. The only story that I have heard was from Marty Zielinski, who is Gacy's photographer, and he worked with him on contract jobs. And he said that Gacy was renovating the roller rink, the Rainbow Roller Rink on Clark. And then when Gacy told him, oh, throw all this garbage in this one area, and then it was sealed up. Well, when they demolished that roller rink, they found two bodies, and nobody's really talked about it. People have tried to find out more information. There may be some there, but personally, I think of studying Gacy and serial killers, I don't think there were. I think he learned from his events in Waterloo when, you know, he had a kid, he hired a kid to beat up another kid, and then both those kids went to the police. He realized he could be ratted out. Now, I do know these kids were digging ditches down there, so they were involved in that way, but I seriously don't think, you know, they knew about it, and I don't think Gacy, in a way, would have been that stupid to throw these bodies all over the place. He learned from the Houston mass murders. Keep the bodies in one location or on your property. Who's going to find them? Nobody.
Plus, they're souvenirs. I suppose there's that secondary benefit when you're a serial killer, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and we know Gacy got off on all this stuff.
Yeah.
Just imagine all those parties he had and just laughing and knowing that all these bodies, while all these people were in his house, they're all under the house.
So it's well known. Actually, some people in my listening audience may not know this, but prior to his crime spree, his murder spree in Chicago, he had been incarcerated in Waterloo, Iowa. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that piece of his history and how that might have provoked him to start killing rather than just injuring?
Yeah, Gacy's career of crime began in Waterloo, Iowa. He managed some KFC chicken shops. He was good with the police, the politicians, the JC members out there. And then he was a manager of a motel where he ran a prostitution ring and a gambling ring out of. Some people say that, you know, there are stories that he would have sex with his wife on the bed while one of these young kids was chained up. Just all these strange things. But people don't know that a lot of the impetus for all this was really in Waterloo. He came to one of his victims with a knife and said, play dead. Now, that's his fascination with death as well, which he said he started at 16 years old, being fascinated by death. So then he goes to Anamosa Penitentiary for a sodomy charge, and he's learning in there. They gave him a white shirt. He brought a miniature golf course from another state and built it there for the prisoners, which is still there to this day. They loved him in the prison. They didn't want to see him go. He did so good. He was in the choir, he was a cook there, but he learned how to fool people and how to put on this persona of this great guy, and that's why everyone loved him. Because even my sister asked once, oh, you found out about his life, he must have been a mean guy. I'm like, no, he was great, people loved him. And that's, you know, that how does that happen? Like you said, a sense of humor.
And I, you know, it's really hard to talk about that in the same breath as saying right. his name, because there's nothing funny about anything he did, and I want to make myself clear, but you would be remiss if you didn't talk about that as a piece of his personality that likely helped him lure in the young men and boys in the first place. Because it's really hard to be afraid of someone who's making you laugh, right? And when the police would come and he could deflect all of that darkness with a joke or a quip, and he was very good at it.
Right.
And so I think his sense of humor was part of his arsenal.
It was, yeah, and he made everybody love him. And that's why, you know, coming from, again, Marty Zielinski, he said he would tell stuff, and we'd be like, yeah, he could have told us, hey, we got, you know, I got 20 bodies in my crawl space. They would have said, yeah, whatever, because he was always joking about stuff.
Right, so that's bragging why nobody took him. About odd things.
That and, too, yeah, right.
He was a quintessential BSer, let's just put
yes,
it that
exactly.
way. We're talking to John Borowski, who just released a wonderful new documentary called The John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago. It's available on Amazon Prime. I encourage you to get it. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about whether or not there were other perpetrators that helped Gacy do some of these crimes. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. You know what? John Borowski is here with me. He is a filmmaker, and he just came out with a wonderful documentary, The John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago. And I think it's the 45th anniversary of his conviction. on or about, like, yeah, in this time zone. Yeah, 45 years.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and as you said, you were six. I was just a little bit older, but I'm still younger than you, John, just so you know. You know, I just remember when that happened. I remember distinctly people in my block were taking bets. There was one body, there were five, there were seven, you know, and no one could ever have guessed how many there were. And, you know, I just remember it was such, it really was a more innocent time. You know, I mean, I didn't know what that was. I didn't understand. I asked my mother, I didn't even know what a crawl space was. Like,
right.
Mom, who's this guy? What is he doing? But let's, there's a texter from the 815 area code. Please speak about Gacy's connection to the nationwide and possible international sex trafficking ring. What do you know about that, John?
You know, I know it's been talked about. It's been talked about, especially in recent documentaries, you know, and some of these more recent documentaries focus more on the sensational aspects of the case. And this is one of them. So in Houston, I think it was 1968, Dean Corll was murdered by this guy, Elmer Wayne Henley, who was a friend of his. And then it comes out that Dean Corll befriended Elmer Wayne Henley, and he would use Elmer Wayne Henley to acquire young men and bring them back to Corll's place, where they would be knocked out, they would be chained to a torture board, they would be abused in many different ways. I can't even describe how badly they abused them, and then they would murder them. And after they murdered them, they would take them to a boat shed, which of course they only had the key to, and the floor of the boat shed was dirt. So they would cover the bodies in plastic, throw them in a hole that they dug in the shed, and then pour lime over the bodies. And they did this for, you know, many young boys. And in the end, Dean Corll was going to kill Elmer Wayne Henley, so he killed him first. And that's how the case came about. But Elmer Wayne Henley would go out and procure these young boys and bring them back to Corll, and they were both involved in these tortures and murders.
And it seemed like Corll really groomed this kid. This kid, yeah, came from, you know, not the worst background, but he was certainly susceptible to an older man helping him out, giving him maybe drugs and money or whatever. And, you know, and Gacy had that same thing going on. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about how there was a parallel there?
Yeah, because Gacy, it's interesting. I talked to Elmer Wayne Henley on the phone at one time.
He's still in prison.
Yeah, he's still in prison. And I told him that Gacy said that you inspired him the way he committed these crimes. And then Elmer Wayne Henley said, well, he's got to blame somebody. And we know that there's always blame. But it was very similar. Gacy had the dirt crawl space below his house. He buried them down there and put many of them in plastic, put lime over their bodies, pretty much exactly the same way. And he figured, well, hey, if they have this boat shed and nobody's going in there, nobody's going to go into my crawl space. And there was that torture board. Gacy made a torture board where he would put handcuffs on it and handcuff the legs of his victims while he tortured and raped them. So there were many parallels. But, you know, and so John Norman was involved with that, you know, Houston mass murders thing, because there was this whole nationwide supposedly child porn ring. And it's been said that one of the people who worked for Gacy for one day was kind of involved in that child porn ring. And because of that, there has been all these conspiracy theories that Gacy was involved in that child porn ring. But as many times as people say that, they said, oh, they used to have a room full of index cards with all these kids that they would use for these sex toys. Well, you know, there's no more. There's no proof of that. So I don't know, you know, how could you say that when there is no proof of it? Because the one guy worked for Gacy for one day. I don't think he was, personally. I think either he picked these kids up from the street, like he did that one victim that said there was another person in the room with them that, you know, when he was being raped, or he might have some of these young guys in the car with him that got out of the car and said, hey, yeah, you want to smoke a joint? You want to come with us? And maybe they grabbed him, or they just walked in the car and said, yeah, we'll go party with you. Because as you know, in the 70s, people hitchhiked, they went everywhere. They didn't even think about it because there was no knowledge of these serial killers.
Absolutely. And we have another texter who said, I know a man who shares many personality traits with John Gacy. He's the most violent and unstable person I've ever met. Don't make that introduction. Sexual perversions, active in the community, and successful in business. And I think that that's an interesting juxtaposition, because we see that in the Gilgo Beach murders, if anyone followed that out, yes, on Long Island, where all of those young women sex workers are now, you know, they've been found, but no one knew and connected it with this architect who was a successful Manhattan architect, married, children, the whole shot, very similar to Gacy, had this ostensibly a perfect life, you know, where he, you know, was successful and yet he was going out at night and doing these things. So,
and they say there aren't serial killers anymore. Well, there are. You know, they're learning how to adapt. You know, obviously there are video cameras and cell phones everywhere, but they are still out there, you know, and we do have to learn these lessons for them. And that's why it's important for these stories to be told.
Absolutely. And on that line, a lot has been said over the years. Why wasn't Gacy caught? And, you know, there were boys that escaped that brought, you know, wanted to bring charges. Charges were brought. Charges were dropped. Gacy was the last person to see a bunch of these young men alive. They worked for him. And everyone should have known, but maybe they didn't, that he had this incarceration for sex crimes up in Waterloo, Iowa. So all in all, you say to yourself, why? And what's the answer to that, John? Because you're not buying into the conspiracy theory that the police in any way were involved.
No, I don't think so. I don't think the police were involved, and I think they get a bad rap. You know, I mean, you know, people have to understand and research. Even at that time period, they didn't know, you know, how these things were occurring with law enforcement. There was nothing they could do in that sense. They did. Chicago police had a stakeout on Gacy for 2 weeks at one point. A lot of people don't know that. They think, oh, they weren't doing their job there. That was all they could do. If someone said, hey, my son was last seen with Gacy, the police would go to his house. Gacy would open the door, invite them in, show them all the pictures of it being a clown and when he was with, you know, the first lady. And they were like, okay, they would leave. There's nothing they could do. There was no DNA typing at that time. That was early 80s, early 90s. So there was nothing they could do. The house was fine and they just left. What did people expect them to do at that time period? There was lack of technology. I mean, think about this. The detectives from the Des Plaines Police Department, they're following this worldwide mass murderer, and they have to use quarters to go to payphones because their CBs didn't work when they got out of range from their base. So it's like there's absurdity in this case too, but it's like, yes, these things actually happen. And it was just a lack of technology. You know, the districts at that time didn't communicate with each other. You could have three districts in a corner, you know, and none of these districts are telling each other about a missing person from the other case. And all these, there were no computers, so there were just files on missing persons, of little index cards, thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of them. So I don't fault the Chicago police at all. Through my research, they did everything they could.
And that makes sense. We have to just put ourselves back to that in that time frame. We did not have the connected systems to do that. And I, you know, he wouldn't have made it to 33,
right,
under any circumstances.
Exactly. I don't think the police or any other officials were involved. And personally, I don't think anyone else was involved with the murders. And whenever you want to talk about that, we could talk.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a thought that the two young men who were living with Gacy at the time during some of his crime spree weeks that he was doing these things, that they were complicit and that they must have known what Gacy was doing because they were the ones, and they testified at trial, that they actually went into that crawl space and dug the trenches. So how did they not know? So what is your response to that, having researched this for as many years as you have?
Yeah, you know, Bill Kunkel, who is the head prosecutor of the Gacy case, you know, I saw him like he was this wizard of the Gacy case. He kind of knew all the details. I would email him or call him. He'd come back and tell me big explanations about these things. And yes, Gacy did have sex parties there. Kunkel said he did, where there were men and young boys there having sex parties. And then, you know, one of the victims that, now the victims that got away from Gacy, he let them go. They didn't escape. He let them go. So there were many victims people don't realize that Gacy just let go because he didn't think they were a threat. And he told one of the victims that, don't worry about going to police because they won't believe you. And he did, and they didn't believe him. So by that point, Gacy reached this height of, you know, his attitude that he thinks he could get away with everything. And I don't doubt there may have been somewhere in that house in that house that night when Gacy was torturing them, but they didn't, there was no murder that night. Because I think, once again, Gacy didn't want other people to know. And if these young kids were digging ditches, he would scare them. He'd say, I work for the mafia and there are bodies down there. And when you go down there, you got to dig between these sticks and these ropes that I put down there. And I think he scared them because, you know, there was a term one of these young men said what Gacy would do is he would mess around with their mind. So he would make them think things were happening. So I think these kids were scared and may have thought they were down there, but I don't think they did any, they were involved in any of the actual killings or murders themselves.
Very interesting. John Borowski, you have just released this 8-part series, John Wayne Gacy Murders, Life and Death in Chicago. Tell our listeners how they might listen and watch this this wonderful document. And I say wonderful, I think what I say when I say wonderful, it's because it really has a lot of explanations of what, how this could have happened, how a Gacy could have been formed.
Yeah, and that was what I wanted to do initially, and that was the goal, to so viewers would have this well-formed view of him and why he did these things. And it's on Amazon Prime streaming, and if you go to GacyMurders.com, that's the website, and you can find out more information, and it's also on physical copy, DVD and Blu-ray.
John Borowski, thank you so much for joining me, and always good to see you.